The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and we have a great show for you today. I'm here in the studio with chef and owner of two great restaurants here in New York, Jimmy Bradley. Jimmy has the Red Cat and the Harrison. Red Cat opened up in 1999 and the Harrison in 2001. Extremely impressive longevity for restaurants here in New York, and certainly due to the quality and talent of Jimmy and his team's work. So, Jimmy, thank you so much for being in the studio with us today.
Thank you, Joe. Good morning.
It was really surprising to me to find out. So we're here on In the Drink, and you have quite a family lineage when it comes to wine, which was a surprise for me to find out, and it's why we have you here on the show today. Can you tell us a little bit about your background with wine?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess we'll start with a last name like Bradley might not lead you down the road to believe that, you know, I could be in the wine business or even perhaps half Italian. But my family, in two different aspects of it, has been in the wine business since 1886 in Alba, Italy, and then also as well in Cucamonga, California, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in the 50s through the 80s.
Okay, so in 1886, they're up in Piedmont. And you're part of the Pio Cesare family.
Yes, that's correct. It's the winery is named Pio Cesare. The man who runs it now, his name is Pio Balfa, and he is my cousin, and he's a fourth generation proprietor. So prior to him, his father, prior to that, his grandfather, and Pio Cesare is his great grandfather.
So did you always grow up knowing about the side of the family in Italy and the family's wine business? Was this something that was constantly in your head or drilled down as a kid, you got to join the family's wine business?
Yeah, somewhat. I grew up in Philadelphia and also in Rhode Island. And so when I was in Philadelphia, the family's name is Pio. The last name is Pio. My great-grandfather's name is Bartolomeo Pio. So he moved to America, and he started a wine business in Pennsylvania, but he dabbled. He had lots of other things, hardware store, Christmas trees, you name it.
Sounds like a resourceful guy.
Well, I guess it's the immigrant mentality and five kids in a new country. So, yeah, very resourceful. So we would see things, you know, my grandmother and her brothers and sisters, everybody lived near each other, and they were old world, so sausage makers and cheese makers and always messing around with food and food in the house and then drinking wine with meals, whether it was lunch or dinner, daytime or nighttime. And I hadn't seen that in the Bradley side of the family. And so I guess...
So they were the fun side of the family.
Well, the Irish and the Italians have some things in common, and I got a lot of good stories, so we'll see how many we can share with you today. But I guess the long and the short is I had opportunities to see about wine and food at a young age in Pennsylvania, and then later on, opportunities to travel to Italy to see it in a different way or firsthand and participate with the family over there.
Do you remember any of the your first memories of stories about the old world? Because a lot of times you see these Italian immigrant families, such as even as my own, where everyone kind of came here and you don't have that kind of direct connection to the old world.
Yeah, my great-grandfather, Bartolomeo Pio, very old school. He He married a woman, my great-grandmother. She died. He went back to the village where he met her and married her cousin.
No.
Brought her back to America because he felt that, you know, the old world women contributed on a different level. And he would speak about that and things like that. So it was...
Like in front of American women?
Yeah, somewhat. You know, it could be a little odd or uncomfortable, but it was really, you know, his preference and how he wanted to go about what he wanted to do. And, you know, the interesting thing is he had five kids, and he had five kids work with him, work for him, and then subsequently run the company after he died. So he was able to do some interesting things, and then to bring some people along, bring some family members along with him. And the company still exists today. I don't know exactly when the company was established. I think it was in the 40s. But there's a company named Bartolomeo Pia Wines and Spirits that still functions today out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And their function is to import and distribute wines? Or
correct. Like, for instance, they're the largest distributor of Pio Cesare wines in the Pennsylvania, New Jersey market.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, being in that Pennsylvania, being Pennsylvania as a control state, I'm sure they have to deal with all sorts of strange, you know, you always hear that Pennsylvania is the largest purchaser of so many different brands because itself is a control state and they have so much buying power.
Correct. Yeah, and, you know, there's certain days you can buy alcohol and certain days you can't, and only specific places to buy wine and spirits in that are owned and governed and licensed by the state. So, yeah, I don't know how many control states there are, but Pennsylvania has a huge buying power and a pretty significant lobbying power. I don't believe my family has any seats or knowledge or a way to influence anything that goes on that level. But, you know, the business is considerably smaller than it was when it first opened, because when they first brought it about, they made wine, and now they don't make wine anymore. They just distribute people's wine.
Mm-hmm. And growing up, were you thinking that you would potentially work with the family business, or, you know, obviously you took a very different path?
Well, yeah, on the Italian side of the family, with lots of aunts and uncles and nieces and nephews, we were all thought of as workers. So things like loading trucks and, you know, duties like that, manual labor duties like that, were what you did after school. My cousin Bart Pio, who runs the company now, and myself were the two boys. He's a little older than I, so it was somewhat of a speak that one of us would perhaps run the company one day. And I just didn't really have it in me to be a salesperson. It wasn't my real desire, a little bit like John Cusack in Say Anything. You know, are you familiar with that line?
No, go for it.
He's courting a woman, and her father says, "What do you do?" And he says, you know, I don't do anything, but this is what I don't want to do. I don't buy things. I don't sell things. It's somewhat of a cute line, but I didn't see myself being in sales. Obviously, I'm in sales now in a certain way, but I decided that when I was going to school and studying business, that I was more interested in the culinary arts than in the business arts at that moment in the 80s.
And at that time, do you have any distinct culinary memories? Was there an Italian grandma making sauce on Sundays? Did you have these big? I'm picturing a big Italian family that gets together on Sundays and has these huge meals with the wines from the old world.
Yeah,
is
definitely.
That true?
Yeah, you know, it's a little cliche or stereotypical. You know, my grandmother taught me how to cook, la la la. But in this specific case, we did, when I lived in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. We did dine at 1 o'clock every Sunday, listening to, you know, the opera from the Met and drinking wine and eating whatever it was, and lots of great food. You know, so when I had my first chef job and the chef said, "Let's make some raviolis," and he made raviolis, I was like, "Wow, I know somebody who makes better raviolis than you do." So a little bit, you know, because they would buy grapes, right? So they would make wine in their basement to experiment, and they would make sausages and put cheeses down, and there was always something to look at. And then there was lots of my cousins who had no interest at all in anything old world. So there was only a few of us that seemed to be corruptible to the old world ways, and I guess I was one of them.
Yeah, and did you take any trips to the old world at that time? Did you go? Did you visit Italy?
Yeah, I hadn't. I guess I made my first trip to Italy in the 80s, maybe after 85, in between 1985 and 1990, which is, you know, pretty good section of years for drinking wine in Italy, right?
Oh, yeah. The lira can go pretty far.
Yeah. And so, but like I was saying, my aunts and uncles and the older generation all worked for my grandfather. Mm-hmm. So the deal was you would work 11 months a year, all day and all night. And then 1 month a year, he would give you a car and put you on a boat to Genoa with your family. And you would have 4 or 5 weeks off on him, you know, sponsored by the company, and you would be with your family driving around Italy, and, you know, it'd be a holiday, but you would be, I guess, doing some types of duties, or at least research and things like that. So there was lots of stories about that, but I was never really part of that generation. So I guess the first time I went just for a holiday, but I went to get reacquainted with Pio Balfa. Like, we had known each other and met each other at lots of family gatherings, but they're usually all about distractions. A family gathering would probably be a wedding or a funeral, and there's, you know, not a lot of time to share with somebody in those moments. So I guess I went over there just to visit, and that kind of reconnected us. And I was saying, look, I don't want to sell wine, but I want to make food, and hopefully one day we'll do business together, but probably in a different way than we had thought about from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. And so you've been going somewhat consistently over the years. How have you noticed that Piedmont has changed?
pardon me. Piedmont's changed radically. I mean, a lot of things in the wine world have changed radically, you know, in the sense of like Tuscany and pouring Cabernet into Sauvignon Blanc, I'm sorry, into Sangiovese and things like that. The Piedmont is very old school, but you see things now like perhaps a I'm sorry, horizontal, what do they call those tanks when you lay it down?
Fermenters.
Yes, yeah. Thank you. You know,
roto fermenters.
Traditionally, they'd be a vertical tank, and now they have horizontal ones with you know, adulation in them. So instead of laying wine down for 30 days, you can maybe do it in 4 days. So I've seen a lot of approaches, new school approaches, both in growing grapes that are not indigenous to the region, different ways to blend wine, and different techniques of fermenting and aging wine. I would say they would be the three number one characteristics of the changes that have taken place in Piedmont over probably the last 20 years. I mean, it's an old school thought that most people use, but then there's a good amount of and they're not new producers, but they're perhaps younger producers, and they're a little bit interested in tinkering around with the formulas that they inherited.
Do you find that you're drawn to more of those more traditional wines with the indigenous grapes and the old school wooden fermenters, or are you kind of equally as open to any good wine?
Yeah, no, it's the latter. I'm very much open. Although I would say for my palate, I prefer an old world style wine. I prefer something with a little more nuance in it than look at me, listen to me approach to making and drinking wine. Sometimes they're overly extracted or aged, and they have a generous amount of flavor. Like a new world Sauvignon Blanc to me is not as desirable as an old world one, no matter where it comes from. Interesting more so to taste the grape than the other flavors that you might be able to achieve with the grape.
Yeah, yeah. It's I also like those kind of more nuanced wines as opposed to very obvious flavors.
Yeah.
I'm with you on that.
And I don't think there was a lot of that, you know, before the 80s. But then you saw, you know, the first one was the big Burgundian-style California Chardonnays that took on a life of their own, mm-hmm. you know. And then I was speaking about Sauvignon Blancs, you know, the Southern Hemisphere Sauvignon Blancs of, you know, New Zealand and Australia are very wildly different than a white Bordeaux or an American Sauvignon Blanc. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, sure, they're supposed to be. A Sancerre is not supposed to taste like an American Sauvignon Blanc, but I don't know if a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is supposed to taste like a slice of grapefruit either.
All right. We are going to take just a quick break. We'll be back with more of In the Drink with Jimmy Bradley today here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
You are listening to Intrigue by Obesity on the heritageradionetwork.org. Stay tuned for more from In the Drink.
Today's program was brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run digital and offset print house that brings together eco-friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Using environmentally responsible papers, non-toxic inks, and wind power, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and mindful sustainability. Rolling Press offers advice on reducing paper waste and energy consumption, helping you save money and minimize your carbon footprint. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
Right, we're back with Jimmy Bradley here on In the Drink. Jimmy, you opened up the Red Cat in 1999 in Chelsea. Tell us how did wine play into the opening of that restaurant? What were people drinking at that time? What were your thoughts and approach to? Did you have say in the wine list? And how do you think that things have changed?
I did the opening wine list with the fellow who was my opening manager, Chris Correo, who is a wine salesman now in New York City. He was with me for a few years and then decided to get into the wine full time instead of the restaurant business. And you know, I guess Chelsea was very different then, and 10th Avenue didn't have much going on, and we felt as though we needed to tell a story and position ourselves, because it wasn't about, you know, who you had worked for and a lot of a generous backstory. It was a little bit of making it up as you go along. It was my first restaurant that I owned in New York City in 1999. So I guess, you know, wine factors into every, in my mind, wine factors into anything that has to do with food. And so, you know, the initial thought was, let's have some very interesting things, and let's give some great value, and let's be able to talk about it, and let's not do it in like a hierarchy system. Let's do it as a team. So instead of having management very knowledgeable about the wine, which of course we would ask them to be, and we would ask them to order it, because it's a big responsibility ordering, you know, millions of dollars worth of wine a year. But to really bring it down to the servers and to have a program where they're very comfortable with it. And you know, just trying to give a list that was interesting that we could afford. So I think we opened with maybe 70 bottles. I think we probably have a few hundred now, and to just let it grow and let it grow around the cuisine, around what we enjoy to drink and what our guests perhaps ask us to provide for them would be, you know, some of the ways that we would approach it. I wanted to, most people and most operators in New York City, if you order a glass of wine, they bring you a glass of wine. And I didn't think that was as interesting as it could be. I wanted to pour the wine table side, and I wanted to give people tastes. So we were doing that, and I hadn't seen a lot of that before 1999, and that's somewhat de rigueur now.
No, at this point, if I order a glass of wine and they just bring the glass of wine to the table, it's a surprise.
It is, yeah. Wasn't actually the case then. No one was really talking about cocktails in the style mm-hmm. of the restaurants that we have. We sell, you know, the majority of the money that we sell from the from selling beverages comes from selling wine. I think it's probably about a 70-30 split food to beverages, and then out of that 30%, 50% of that 30% is wine by the glass. So, you know, we have probably 25 wines that we offer by the glass. And then the only thing I try to do there is no vendor, no house or no vendor gets any more than one wine by the glass to keep everybody honest and to keep mm-hmm. it working properly. It's very easy to have three people give you six things each and lean on them. I don't really believe in that system. I think if I make my job just a little bit harder, I'm probably able to tell a better story. So I'm always looking at that type approach. So if there's 25 wines, there's 25 vendors. Most people would be very scared of having 25 vendors. I have 40, and it doesn't intimidate me at all, because it's the only real, honest way that I know that it's all fair and everybody's being asked to do the same thing and provide the same way. Mm-hmm. And the person who does it the best with you gets it. And the person who doesn't get it. But, you know, everybody should know that. That's tied to the laws of supply and demand.
Yeah, and it's something that I struggle with from time to time, because there's, you know, there's like 250 vendors here in New York of wine. And a lot of times I want to, you know, root for the small guy too, and just give him a shot. But you're right. Every time you take on a vendor, it does require more work for you. You're going to meet with them more. They're going to email you more. So we also work with the 40 to 50 different vendors, which I think is a lot for the industry. But I think it's a great way to keep your list alive, and to make sure that you're constantly working to think about what's the next new good thing here. Let's keep it fresh.
And it's a consistent message. It's consistent with the providers, and it's consistent mm-hmm. with the guests. We are not going to buy the things that just sell, and we're going to look to do something a little bit more interestingly, but we're going to be able to give you a value and explain it to you in the process. Like, for instance, I'm pretty sure the three number one selling dishes in America are fried calamari, tuna tartare, and Caesar salad. Doesn't matter where you are, but I'm pretty sure those are the big ones. So, like, what are the ones in wine? And if I figured that out, I would say, I don't want to serve that. And it's not that I think there's anything wrong with that. I think there's a more interesting way to perhaps do it. So, again, if I take the things that I know are the easiest things to sell and I decide not to sell them or to sell them in a different way, mm-hmm. I've created a situation where it's perhaps more difficult for me. But I also feel like it's a more thoughtful approach, and it's a better story. So, yeah, there's nothing wrong with tuna tartare. I mean, fried calamari can be the best thing there is, but you're not going to go to the Red Cat and get fried calamari and a glass of Chardonnay. It's just not going to happen. And it's not that there's anything wrong with them. It's just that we're a little bit more interested in telling a broader story than what we know is going to sell. I don't think that's the most interesting story that we could provide. I mean, that's a story for a different kind of operator.
Well, tell us the story about what kind of wines you put on the list there. What are the types of producers that you're drawn to, and how do you go about food and wine pairing?
Well, there's really nothing off limits, because there's nothing. Wine and food are completely symbiotic in our approach. And so then I would say, what does the menu do? The only real direction for the menu is it can't be fusion and it shouldn't touch anything Asian, but it can be rooted in this pretty broad, multicultural, somewhat Mediterranean approach of the cuisines of around the Mediterranean. There's probably 7, 8, 10 countries around it and broader influence than that. So we would look for wines that aren't, you know, your go-to generic over-the-counter wine. We would look to wines to fit perfectly with the flavors of the food. We would look to see if we could find value. We would look in odd shaped and sized bottles to see what we could do there, and to see. And I enjoy pouring wine by the glass out of magnums and double magnums, and feel there's some interesting stories and value in there. So a lot of what we do isn't just what we don't say this is what we want to do. We basically say, this is what we don't want to do. Let's make up what we want to do together. So we'll sit around with the chef and the wine person and myself, and we'll say, well, if we know what we don't want to do, what do we really want to do? And what does it look like? And then everybody puts their 2 cents in, and you start to see a document.
Yeah, I mean, you guys have a fantastic wine list, and that... And I've always, I think, hired great people. I've been coming in for quite some time before we opened up Delaniman 07, before I worked at Babbel, before all that. I was actually selling wine, doing the thing that you said you didn't want to do. And the Harrison was one of the... actually, the Harrison and both Red Cat were two of the few places that actually bought wine from me.
Nice. Which company were you with?
I was with Vinifera.
Oh, sure. Great company.
And always had, you know, you always hired professionals who, there's a lot of people who don't treat their wine reps very nicely. And, I was always received very, very nicely. So luckily I, you know, since those were two of my only accounts that actually bought wine, I had a lot of meals at the time.
Thank you
impressed.
For your patronage. Yeah, I mean, Joe, I guess the way I look at it is you can't really kick somebody closer to you, you know? So this whole thing about having demands and being a difficult person, sure, fine, you know? And that might even be the New York way, but I'm pretty sure there's more ways than just one to do something. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, I want my approach to be something that's more like how I would prefer to act or be treated than this game or charade that I play with a certain group of people that I purchase with. And then I wouldn't have a different relationship with someone who sold me meat than I would with somebody who sold me wine, because what I'm more or less interested in is the relationship. If I have a certain thing with you and we speak to each other and you have an idea of what I want and what I want to do and what my thresholds are, we can probably do some pretty interesting things. If you're just bringing me stuff that you want to get rid of, you know, I hate you and I'll make it known. So, you know, if we can do this thing together, it's going to be great. Now, you know, the traditional business approach would be, how do I make money? You know, because that's what we're trying to do. But that would be one of the gears in our wheel, you know. So sure, fine, but what's the value and what's the story and how does this fit with the food and how does this work into our style of service? And once we answer all those, then we can provide a list and specific wines that we would like to offer our guests.
Yeah. So now, has it all come full circle? What's your relationship like with Pio Cesare? Are you selling the wines at the restaurants and you have good business and family relationship with the family?
Yeah, I go to Italy 3 or 4 times a year. Pio comes to America 3 or 4 times a year, so we see each other. We take a family holiday. We used to make wine together, proprietary wine for the Red Cat and the Harrison. We stopped doing that, but we always sell his wine. We always offer one of his wines by the glass, and then one he probably makes about 18 or 19 different varietals that he brings to America. So we try to have 2, maybe 3 on each list. Like I said, they used to be proprietary. We got away from that because I didn't want a wine that said Red Cat Pio Cesare on the label being sold by someone other than myself. And so when they changed some of the regulations in New York City, or New York State, I should say, mm-hmm. I just decided to move away from that approach, knowing that Pio makes amazing wine, and it really didn't matter that we had our label on it. You know, somewhat similar to, like, perhaps the Union Square, they had a deal with Rocca Manzoni, you know, the Vino Big, and they were pouring the Big Big, I guess, for years and years, but Danny never asked them to call it the USC Big Big, mm-hmm. you know. So when I was saying to Pio, wouldn't it be nice if we had your name and my name on the label? Like, yeah, sure, great, let's do it. And after 3 years of doing it, it's really more about your wine, Pio, than what it is what we make together.
What was your influence in the wine? And
well, we would do blends. Mm-hmm. So I would make the blend with him. It'd be he and I and his winemaker in a room pouring wines together until we got what we wanted. And so we would make a red, and we would make a white, and sometimes we would make a rosé. And the red was usually Barbera-based with some other things added into it that could be, you know, like a Syrah, but it could also be like a Dolcetto. And then the white was a agave-based varietal that, you know, and every year, because every year the grapes are different, so we would taste the varietals, and then we would think about how to blend it.
This sounds like a blast.
Yeah.
It sounds like a lot
for
of
sure.
fun.
It was a boondoggle. It was, you know, I have to go to work in Italy. That's what I would say to my staff. And then, you know, we would sit around for 3 days and drink wine.
All right. Well, Jimmy, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much. Guys out there, if you have not been yet, I don't know what you're waiting for, but definitely please go visit the Red Cat and the Harrison, two not only classic restaurants, great restaurants here in New York City, but great places to drink wine as well. So Jimmy Bradley, thank you so much. It's been great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Joe.
And thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.